From the campus of the University of Hawaii, this is the Center for Southeast Asian Studies Speaker Series Podcasts. Podcasts, video streaming, MP3 downloads, and more are available at csehawaii.com.
Seminar series for the Center for Southeast Asian Studies. And today we have something a little unusual. We had an opportunity to take advantage of the tail end of a scholar who was at the end of a four-month Fulbright program in the mainland, and he was at Georgia State College, and he's been looking at historic preservation in the United States, and Hawaii's going to be part of that topic. Adanyong Tanit Kimosatian is a graduate of Tualan Kōrang University's Architecture School. He has a master's in planning from AIT in Bangkok and a PhD in planning from and historic preservation from the University of Tokyo. He's been working for many years in the field of architectural conservation and more generally cultural preservation throughout Thailand. He's done projects ranging from cultural landscapes in Monta Bari and Somat Som Khang to an extensive, I would say, close to 20-year study of the shop houses and old fabric of Phuket in southern Thailand. He serves on the Thai ICOMOS committee and is now involved in a number of projects that touch upon Khmer sites in northeast Thailand. He's been on the Thai committee for Kosop Pevihan. He's been working with Thai ICOMOS to look at a possible nomination for Khmer sites throughout northeast Thailand. And so I think it's a really great opportunity to have him here and a chance to see this work that he's been doing for over 10 years now on shop houses in Southeast Asia, and including Thailand and Phuket, and Penang and Malacca and Malaysia. So thank you all for coming, and touching on.
So good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. And first of all, I'd like to thank the Southeast Asian Studies, Ajahn Dayan and Ajahn Chapman, to give me this opportunity to share my experience with you. And I'm very pleased and very happy to be here, especially the very welcoming and the hospitality is received by Ajahn Chapman and everyone in here, including Teresa, who's helping me a lot before coming here. Yes, managing. So today I'm going to talk about my work more than a decade. Yes? So I'm going to talk about my experience of working with the shop houses in southern Thailand and Singapore and Malaysia. Actually, I started my first shop house work with the Singaporean shop houses. When I was a student at the University of Tokyo, the university through the Japanese Office of the Cultural Affairs under the Ministry of Education sent me to work with the people in the Urban Redevelopment Authority in Singapore about the urban planning and urban design and the historic district in here you call, but at that in Singapore they call it conservation area. They use a British system for a while to collect the information and to make a summary on the Singapore's experience in urban design and preservation in 1991. I was my early 20s or something, and then I went to work with some people in Singapore. And later on, I came back to Thailand after finished my education. And I was teaching at Asian Institute of Technology for 2 years before joining the public university in Thailand in Bangkok. There was a program funded by the German government called the Local Initiative in Management Planning, Environmental Management Planning, and Phuket was one of the pilot projects from the Thai government and the Phuket municipality proposed the old town as a part of the environment improvement. So I was practically involved in that project in 1994. So and later in 1997, the Malaysian governments with the NGO, they were preparing themselves to have the Malacca and Penang on the World Heritage List. So that was 10 years ago, and they were also asking me to help a little bit in the preparation of the legislation for the World Heritage. So I've been involved in with the people and the civic trust in Penang and Malacca since then. So I'm going to talk about my experience for these three countries to you. What I'm going to say is one is about the origin of the shop houses in that region. The second one is the characteristics and the cultural significance. And the third one is the preservation approaches, which are quite different amongst the three countries, because we have different political and administration contexts. So we share the same culture that you are going to know this time. In the US, when you talk about the shop house, the continental US, the continental American people had a lot of questions, because they don't understand the term shop house. But actually, we found the term shop house that was officially used in the Singaporean building codes since the Raffles Stamford's period, meaning the colonization period, and they already used the term a shop house in the building regulations. And the next thing of the characteristic of the shop house is it has mixed uses within the buildings. And the mixed uses is you have to be careful when you use about this, because the mixed uses in the American context, maybe it's about the different uses in the building with different type of users. For instance, you may have a commercial or business activities on the ground floor, but on the upper floor you can have the residential apartment, and the people who are using that space are different. But in Thailand or in Southeast Asia, it's the same type of user that are using the same building with different activities. So this is a kind of the difference in the context and in the meaning. And also the shop house is not really the native Southeast Asian people habitat. It came with the Chinese immigrant during the 14th or 15th century, and it started to have a pretty peculiar or very strange style, which is not the common style of the people in the Southeast Asian country. But it was so successful that it becomes the dominant feature of the Southeast Asian countries, where when you go to Southeast Asian cities, you always see the shop house, and shop houses. So this is the meaning of the shop houses. I took this picture from the Chinatown, a shop house in Chinatown in Bangkok, and the ground floor is the shop, and the upper floor is the house, and the same family just living in, they do business and living in the same place. Mm-hmm. And this is also the Chinese community in the shop house in Bangkok. Just took this picture just last year before I came here, and see a lot of work to do in terms of the preservation, in terms of the living quality improvement, and as well as the economic viability. And this is in Hanoi, in Vietnam. As you see, the shop house is having it's even more interesting than in the Chinatown in Bangkok, because you have everything moving around very densely. As well as the shop house is fascinating in itself, because it has the after the French colonization, they have the French architectural elements pasted on the shop houses, which is very interesting. This is Bangkok, and you can see the majority of the buildings are the shop houses. Unfortunately, the building construction statistic, we did not classify type of building as a shop house. So we cannot find exactly the percentage or the number of the shop house in comparison to detached buildings or other buildings. And this is the way the native Asian people live. In all four regions in Thailand, we just live above the ground or on the water, not living on the ground, not build the building on the ground like this. So it's when it comes to the shop house after the Chinese came, it's the first place in Malacca. You can see the early shop house, yes, on your right hand side. They built the buildings on the ground. Why the native Malay, they call the plank house, because they use the wooden panel on the bungalow house, just more or less like the Hawaiian vernacular house in here, but it's pretty much smaller. And you see, they just live above the ground. So it's a different features of the shop house and the native people's architecture. I'm showing here just a little bit short information about the Chinese influence and the migration pattern. We still are not so sure, so maybe we have to ask Ajahn Rosalmi as well about the Chinese influence in Thailand through the architecture, or we've got the Chinese influence. I think there are two assumptions that they are discussing about the rice cultivation or the rice culture, whether we derive from the Chinese or the Chinese just took it from us. This is the, it depends on the archaeological findings, and we are not so sure. Also in the 13th to 15th century, we found in Sukhothai kiln site, we found the Song artifact, the Song dynasty ceramic as an artifact in the kiln site. And so they believe that there must be a kind of the technological transfer of the ceramic, and making the ceramic from China to Sukhothai. And then the Chinese came in 14th century as a marine trade, and as well as the Arabian. And I highlighted the last three ones. This is the starting point of the West and the East mix. And then this has made the chop houses just look like what you see nowadays in Southeast Asia, particularly in the southern part of Thailand, Malaysia, and Singapore. And this is the Song ceramic and the Sukhothai ceramic, that they have some similarities in terms of the ceramic itself and also the glaze and even the some pattern that is quite a similarity. And this is the map of the Malay Peninsula and most of the Southeast Asia. I will show the east-west navigation since the 1500s, that they have the kind of very busy route around here since Phuket. And Phuket was used as the stop point when during the monsoon season. So when they sail the vessels from here, they cannot go downward because it's the monsoon. So they have to stop at the at Phuket. And there were about 400 houses of the Portuguese during 15th to 17th century in the northern part of Phuket Island. And since this one is very busy, the Chinese and the Arabian came first to Malacca to do the trade, and the Chinese was helping the Sultan or the Muslim people from the defeat of Ayutthaya. Ayutthaya was so powerful at that time, so the Chinese came down here to help the Malay people. And since they were so busy in this area, and there were so many people meeting each other, they said it's the first place of Asia that where the East meets the West in 1509, in the first landing of the Portuguese in Malacca, even before they go up, they went up to Macau. For the mixed culture and mixed people, they have created very new and very unique culture, and they call themselves the Strait Settlements, means the Malaccan Strait, the Strait of Malacca. And they call themselves in Malay language as the Peranakan, The Peranakan means, I'll tell you later. I think most of you will know this one if you are working with the Southeast Asia. The early immigrants were Chinese, Tamil, Indian Tamil, and the Arabian. Most of the immigrants, I think, they said all of the immigrants, the first immigrants were men, not women. So they got married to the local. And then the son or the daughter was called the Peranakan, means locally born. It means just they were born here, but the father is from somewhere else with their mother. And the Tamil is a mix with the local. They call themselves the Chitti. But the Peranakan is more well known because they have more affluent in terms of money and also the business, and it's quite working for them in here. So the new hybrid, Asian itself has created the new culture on the race, language, and attire, food, which is very different from we have in Bangkok, we have in Laos, or in Vietnam. And they normally call themselves as Yonja and Baba. It's Yonja and Baba culture. The Baba is a man, Yonja is a woman who dressed in a very nice one. So this is the people whom I met. And from my friends in Malaysia, the top one, he's a professor in the University of Technology in Malaysia. He has an ancestor from Arab, so he's an Arabian. The bottom one on your right hand side is Mr. Roy Tan. He's a real Peranakan. He has a father from the Fujian region, Fujian province, and his mother is local. So his name is Roy Tan, speaking English. Father are from China, and mother is Malay. And could you imagine the Chinese, some Chinese Christian, the Chinese Buddhist, and the mother is Muslim, speaking English, doing trade with the Portuguese or this one. So they mixed with its other. Even the dress, the attire is different. It's not really Muslim, it's not really Chinese. It's some sort of mix with this one. And this is a jetty in Phuket, which they are doing something very nice. The food as well, if you are a Bangkok people, you see this one, is they use a Chinese herbs with the banana and make the jelly from this. It's a secret recipe, like Coca-Cola, something that they never reveal to the public in here. And here is the bak kut teh. It's a pork rib with the Chinese herb as well, and the soy sauce, the dark soy sauce one. And this is a sweet made with the coconut milk, sugar, and flour to give the energy to the workers in the tin ores. And now becomes really popular among tourists to come in here. So they have made a very nice delicacy of this one. And this is what we call the bihun. Bihun is a thin rice noodle. And this one is just like a laksa in Malaysia, and Singapore, but with the curry and the fermented rice noodle. And we eat it in the morning, just like this. And this is the spring roll, the fresh spring roll. Instead of putting the peanuts, they have a lot of the cashew nut. So even better, they have the cashew nut and putting in this one, in the spring roll. So don't get hungry yet, but yeah, it's kind of, I was very happy when I go, and we found the same thing in Penang and in Malacca as well. And the architecture, talking about the architecture in Penang, the building in Penang that you see today came from the originally from Captain Francis Light, who was a British, and he went to Penang in 1789 and he founded Penang, and he brought the bricks, construction bricks from Bengal and China, as well as the laborers from Bengal to build the shop house and the building and his buildings. In Malacca, even older, the Chinese came, but my friend could not trace back and what is the very original, the oldest Chinese shop house in Malacca. They don't talk about that. Maybe the history is too long, I'm not so sure. But yeah, we have some in Malacca like this. And then the Dutch took over, and then the British colony. So it's kind of mixed. I can show you later the picture afterwards. In Singapore, the starting point of the European influence in the architecture in Singapore started in 1826 when the two British architects were sent from England to work, and these two architects were very fond of Palladian style. It's a subset of the neoclassical. You have a lot of Palladian style in the US, right? And then they built they brought up that very popular style to Singapore architecture. And later it mixed with the Chinese and the native Malay, so you can see kind of the hybrid building as well, not only the people, but also the buildings. And in southern Thailand, it's a little bit misinterpreted before that. We always use the term Chino-Portuguese shop house, which is not really correct because there is no real influence from the Portuguese in Phuket shop house nowadays. Because if you, I will show you later why that thing has happened. We have the Portuguese came to the area during 1500 to 1700s, but they stay in a little bit up north of nowadays Phuket town, and then they've lost because of the, we have many times the war with Burmese. And in Penang, my friend told me that they set up the European club, and most of the European at that time, they were left in Phuket, they just fled to Penang because of the Burmese wars. And then the Chinese migrant came when they moved the town a little bit in the south to do the tin ores. And it's at almost the same time after this, between 1812 and 1851, there was an opium war, and many Chinese just went down to Phuket to do the as a labor of the tin in the tin mining, and become richer and richer in this time. And then since 1851, we just moved the town, and we just have the building of the hybrid building, the European and Chinese, in this town, in this place. So it's not really the Sino-Portuguese because you cannot find the relationship or the connection with the Portuguese in that one. And the timeline, just to show very shortly about this in Thailand is Ayutthaya period. In Malay Peninsula, you can see the red script. And for Phuket is the black one, if you can see. And so since Ayutthaya, there was nothing, I think, in Phuket or in the Malay Peninsula, just a little bit on the Malacca. Mm-hmm. And also during the Bangkok era, they started to have development in Penang and in Singapore. And this is in Phuket. You will see the Europeans just fled away from here, and Phuket town has just moved. Mm-hmm. And then in connection to Bangkok, it comes later, from the minister's visit to Singapore and the king's Rama V and Rama VI visit Phuket at that time. Mm-hmm. And this is why Phuket is different, because the starting point in Ta Lang area, they were recorded that there were Portuguese settlements there, but everything disappeared. I was also helping an archaeologist from England. He's a professor from the University of Sheffield, using the magnetometer to trace back the non-organic substance underneath the ground, where in the place in here where he believed that it should be the origin of the Portuguese settlement. And we found something as well. So we sent all the information to the regional office of the Fine Arts Department in Phuket just a few years ago. And then they moved the town down here after finishing the Burmese war to the name called Gatu, and this is the architectural style. You see the real Chinese shop houses without any influence of the European. And then they moved the town one more time to the Phuket town nowadays, since 1851. Then this is the shop houses that mixed with the Chinese and the European already in here. At the same time, is Penang was 10 or 20 years established, and Francis Light went to Phuket because he had a mistress, a consort. And according to Penang, it's still Islamic state. He cannot have a wife or mistress. So he built the house of his mistress in Phuket because it's can be done easier in Thailand, in Siam at that time. So this is a link. And Francis Light, son, was a founder of the Adelaide in Australia. And there was a book writing about the Phuket, Penang, and Adelaide. This is because of the influence of Captain Francis Light at that time. And this is also, again, the early Chinese migrants that we can find. The oldest chop houses in Malacca is just look like this. You remember the character, which is a little bit different from the what is called the pre-war or the colonial shop houses, because they have a little bit of the roof down here and all are the Chinese characteristics. But after the colonialism, they have some kind of the European features, the neoclassical on the top, on the second floor, and this is in Penang, and you can see. So they now have inventory in Penang. The shop house and all the colonial houses is around 1,400 units, where the shop house is account for about 1,000 units just existing in Penang. They did the survey and inventory in 1994. And this is in Kampong Glam. It used to be a Malay community because Raffles Stamford is just like a very, very British. Divided the land and the settlement. Just, this one is for Indian, Tamil, and this one is for Chinese, and this one is for Muslim, and this one is for European. So it's very separate communities in early Singapore. And you see, you find the same buildings in Phuket. Yeah, so more or less the same. You cannot distinguish, except for the power line. It's like, because the British has done something very good in terms of infrastructure to Penang and Singapore. They put everything underground in the first place. But in Thailand, we just cannot afford that, or we don't have the brain to do so, I'm not so sure. And this is the transformation of the style of the shop houses in Singapore. The early shop houses, we can find the same thing in Phuket, in not so much in Malacca, but in Penang, you can see the same thing. But this is the early style where the Chinese as well as the Muslim live in. And you can see some decorative elements is belonging to the Muslim architecture. And the first transition is just like this. You can still see a lot of the Chinese influence, but later on, the transition period has become more elaborate in terms of the stucco and the craft work as well. And this one in Singapore themselves, they call the Chinese Baroque in here because it's so elaborate in here. And then they just come back to simplicity again after 1930s, like in, I think this one is so much, and they were so boring, and then they just, oh, we go for simplicity, just like the global trend at that time for modernism and Art Deco. The same thing you can find in Phuket, that the original shop house is just like this, but in a very bad treatment, like here, and neoclassical in Phuket, and also the Art Deco. You see the same transformation of the style in terms of style and age. Another feature of the shop house is you can notice that this is a very narrow front, a street, and very long shape like this. So it's just like the very extremely oblong shape. If you can see, this one I made this for the measured work about 15 years ago in one chart house in Phuket. And you can see the open inner court here for better ventilation because you have such a oblong shape here. And if you have too long, you have two breaks of the inner court. And inside, there is a well that you can find the fresh water under the underground. And it's very good because you have no problem of the waterborne disease in here because you are not relying on the water, on the canal or the river. So it's very good for the people. There has been no record of the waterborne disease in Phuket. While in Bangkok, we have 4 or 5 times of the big diarrhea and very serious ones like that. And this is the inner court. Yeah, it's really comfortable in here. A little bit hotter than in Hawaii, but it's still okay. It's livable right here. And this is the furniture, and it's actually originally from China. And the ancestors, most of them told me that this time is the fourth generation already, but the first generation, they came because they escaped from the Opium War. And they have all the information in Chinese, what were they were, and how many vessels that they put in. And some big, rich family, they have even 4 vessels for one family. And they put and they carry everything that they could to Phuket. So Phuket is also, please don't tell the art or the ancient object traders, because if they come to Phuket, they could destroy everything in down here. And again, you can see the chop house in Hanoi. This is one of my friends doing the survey. This is a, they call it a tube-shaped chop houses. And we study why it happened like this. Maybe the adaptation of the Chinese people, or maybe I found one evidence, but I'm still not so sure about the Dutch property law. The Dutch, according to the Dutch law, they collect the tax according to the length of the property that is adjacent to the street. So they take advantage of the, so the people can take advantage of the width of the street. So if when the Chinese came, they, you know, the Chinese, they try to maximize profit and minimize investment. So they're doing and make it something like this. This is just, for me, just the assumption, because when I was in Malacca, I found this document. But I need to do more things about checking this. When I was in, when I was also studying my after PhD in the Netherlands, I tried to find this one. I just had no time. I was so busy with my postdoctorate program. So yeah, I will figure it out afterward. This what is going on, and maybe you can find something like this. And this is another feature of the chop houses, and have the what is called the 5-foot way, the 5-foot veranda way. Because one Malaysian student did his PhD thesis on this, where they come from, just that one. Whether that's is the influence of the Raffles Stanford there when he was staying in India. So the Anglo-Indian style, that one of the part of the colonial style, because in Southeast Asia we have a lot of rains and sunshine, so it's better to have this kind of covered walkway. And it was measured in the Chinese measurement unit, they call the kaki, go kaki. In Southeast Asian people, they call the ngo kaki. Go is 5, ngo kaki. Kaki is, but in Malay term, they use the kaki lima. This one, kaki lima, it's right here. So it's the arcade. It's a covered arcade. It's one of the biggest and very important features of the chop houses at that time. And the, another feature is the treatment of the walls or the facade of the buildings. The upper floor, you can see the European influence, but the Chinese still remain their culture by having the Chinese entrance in here. So this is kind of mix. Yeah. This is very typical in Southeast Asia. And we come to the last topic. It's about the different approaches. So we know already that we have a very cultural significance on the shop houses and the culture, the Peranakan culture, the Phuket culture. But we share the same problem since the 1960s or 70s. We have a lot of destruction of the shop houses. So Singapore has destructed a lot. And then they realize that, oh, we need to preserve because we have nothing to declare that what is the heritage to Singapore. And public development projects, like in the US as well, you have a highway and many things, and the poor treatment and the shortage of the building materials and workmanship due to the modernization and the mass production. And in Thailand we have, and Malaysia we have, the complex land tenure and ownership, which is very difficult to deal with. And it declined population in some places, not the whole places. In Singapore, it's very well done, and it's a pioneer of preserving the shop houses like this. They started with the work of the URA, or the Urban Redevelopment Authority, as the competent authority dealing with the preservation. The movement started in late 1970s and implemented in 1980s. The US government also helped Singapore in terms of the technical assistance in the mid-1980s. They put a lot of effort by applying the Secretary of Interior standard for rehabilitation and preservation to the Singapore. But the Singaporean government had not only the U.S. expert, the call for the French and the British expert as well. Then, according to the British, one of the British Commonwealth, they used the term the conservation area, which is integrated already in the land use plan or the city plan. And the starting point is the very, very economic oriented. According to the British law, the property, if you are renting out the property you have, what is called, you do it in many Commonwealth countries in Asia, by making the ceiling of the rent fee, because it would be affordable to the poor at that time in the 50s and in the 60s. But when they turn into the conservation area, they need the money, right? And then they just wave out the rent control regulation and then put it in the commodity, put it in the market, and then they can raise the funding. But this one, they have to sacrifice with the, what is called the gentrification. There is no native people living in there, because if I cannot afford it, I have to go out. But Singapore has already supporting this process. They build the public buildings, the public housing on the outskirts of the buildings. And they have that, then they have also some exception for the older people, that they can still live in here as well. And what the Singapore has done is in very high quality preservation techniques, very rich one, very high quality for the buildings, and mixed with the design guidelines, where the property owner has to buy the design guideline and have to follow the guidelines according to the recommendation of the URA here. So this is the model of the Singapore downtown, where they have the conservation area here. And they try to negotiate with the development pressure by filling up the land, make a land reclamation, a huge land on this. And then if you want to develop the city, so use the new land, the land reclaimed here. So this one is a new development project. It's reducing the pressure of the development in the conservation area. So this is one of the land policy, land development policy for the Singapore government since around early 1980s. And this is the example of the conservation area demarcated in the planning, in the urban planning process in Singapore. Now Singapore has, they started with the 11 conservation areas, but now they have 94 conservation areas. But some conservation area has only 3 or 4 buildings. That all together is nearly 7,000 units. In Phuket, we have 640 units, very small, very little compared to Singapore. I did the inventory and all of the survey, just finished 5 years ago. And this is a treatment to the buildings that the Singapore has done in Kampong Glam. In here, very nice. And they started with the modernizing and making the also the compliance with the new building codes, with the fire and all the back lane is also open for the fire escape. So the fire escape. So it's very nicely done. And if you can see, you cannot see any kind of this character, town characteristic in anywhere else in the world, where you have a row of the shop house, very small here, and just behind you is a real skyscraper. It's the financial district in here. So it's a world class in here, and you have this very big contrast in terms of land value. You cannot compete with each other, but Singapore can do this. The only Singapore government can do this. Very strict top-down regulations, and also very well done for the preservation standard, in terms of preservation standard. For Malaysia, Malaysia is more or less like in Thailand, that they have the public and private development pressure. But in Malaysia, is even, my friends say, it's even worse, because the public authority also was supporting a huge mega project in the old town. I will show you later. And also in Malaysia, they have the highest associative values in terms of the Peranakan culture and people and the place. And then in Malaysia, the preservation plan was led by or initiated by the advocacy groups, like they have the national one, they call the Badan Warisan. The local group, they have the Pinang Heritage Trust or the Melaka Heritage Trust. The Pinang Heritage Trust is much stronger than the Melaka Heritage Trust. And the Pinang Heritage Trust approached the UNESCO office in Bangkok with the help of some private company, the Lawrence Low. He's an architect. And they try, because they are not so trust with the, they don't really trust with the local government that they will really be preserving the shop houses, the shop house committee. So they would like it to be listed as a World Heritage. It was successful in 2008. But I was helping them also for, not for the architecture point of view, but for the legislation sometimes, for the comparison, this one in 1997. And then they have the movement, such a movement in late in 1980s. Mm-hmm. And 1994, they did the inventory. And they saw it, the World Heritage would be a protective means that they can also advocate and make some controls under the government also. And lately, just 3 years ago, they have this one, just like a review process, the design review process. In the US, you always have the Urban Design Commission or something like that. So, but they call themselves in Melaka Heritage Impact Assessment, HIA. That they are working very much on this. So since Malacca has a very old one, it is worthwhile to be listed as a World Heritage. And this is the work of the local government. You cannot see anything old, but it's just on the shoreline of the Malacca. So we were putting a lot of criticism on this huge development in the old town of Malacca, and it was risky for the World Heritage as well. It's quite threatening. But for the people itself, the NGO and the academician and the university, they have created the campaign for Malacca. It's getting the city back to the people, not giving the city to the developers or something like that. So that's where they are trying very hard. And also, right now in Jonker Street, this one of the oldest Chinese settlements in there, they just have the weekend pedestrianization, and it seems pretty well because I went to Malacca. They were celebrating the first anniversary of getting in the World Heritage, and they invited me to be there as well. And then we have some discussion, and they are doing a very good business in there. So the people, they like it so much, and the government is also enjoying the revenue from tourism. This is a good thing of the World Heritage. And in Penang, they had a design guidelines like this. The local government of Penang, the Penang municipality, established a quasi-governmental company, and in dealing with the private property of the Penang shop houses. But it's quite loose because you allow such a height like this. Not really the original character of the building. So it's, somebody said it may not be working well with this because you have destroyed already the integrity of the whole atmosphere and the setting of the area. In Phuket, it's very late. It started in 1994. And in Phuket, the shop house preservation is not the government priorities. Their priorities even will be given to Ajahn Rasami's work, the prehistoric and the historic Sukhothai and Ayutthaya. So I'm considered the minority in preservation because no policy, no preservation policy towards the old chop houses. It just started in 1997 that the first chop house quarter was listed as a national monument, just like that, but there is no incentive, not anything. So we have to start from the grassroots level because the government, the central government, could not do anything for us. This is my approach in the beginning because I became the advisor to the Phuket municipality on the chop house preservation since 1994. Mm-hmm. And this is the Phuket conservation area, and we have a lot of things to do in here, and we have done a lot of public awareness program in giving the awards also, and the craftsmen, the craftsmen, and also many advocacy group. And this is a kind of the water drawing that's given to the people or using as a, you can sell it as a when the tourists come to Phuket also for the sake of the a heritage in here. And also they know that I was going to get married, so the Phuket people called me, please come and we do everything for you. Ajahn Bill is here. He was dying also. That was a long time ago, 1999. And they reinvented the, what is called the intangible cultural, intangible activities, like playing the puppet, which they stopped playing that for 30 years. And so the Yonya Baba, she was a very old woman, old lady. She was sitting on a wheelchair. And when she saw this, she smiled and her tears, her eyes having tears. And that because she was saying, I never expect to see it again in my life. In here. So it says a meaningful a lot to themselves, to the Phuket people in here. So I was fully used for this, actually. And then we have some kind of the improvement with the private effort, not the government's effort, no incentive, but with the awareness raising and facilitation from the university where I belong. They could even do some kind of a huge development in one lane or one alley that's just like this. And this one is, they said if they can, they will make it like a little New Orleans. They would like to have a kind of the jazz pop in this area. I don't know. And then a lot of improvement through the grassroots program in Phuket. It's kind of like Main Street program, perhaps in the U.S. in the late 70s in here. And that is I think the three countries we have to we share the same culture, but a different treatment and different approach in the preservation. So I think, we share the same culture, but different treatments. So in Singapore, they accept the gentrification and a very high standard. So they are much more preserving the tangible heritage. And in Malaysia, so they call for attention internationally through the World Heritage, so it's kind of the heritage site management. What we are discussing a lot in Malaysia this time, and we are going to have the conference in June, in very soon, about how to ensure the authenticity and integrity, because it's in very high pressure of development from the both central local government and the developers, private developers. We have to be aware of this. But in Phuket, it's a local movement. We need more support in the very appropriate way from the local government, like in giving us a chance or an opportunity to have some kind of incentive at local level, something like that. So decentralization is still very young and not practicability in Thailand. So we have to work a lot more on that. And one of the activities in here is in the U.S. I'm learning the U.S. system to help this out even a little bit or in a large portion. I'm not so sure, but that is my work here as well, just helping the central government to do a better thing to the local government here. So this is the end of my presentation. So thank you very much. So any comments or questions?
We have time for a couple questions. People may have to get going fairly.
I see. Yeah.
Thank you again very much. That was really. I have a couple of questions.
Yes.
In your last slide, you had one shop house with this very obvious Whirlpool advertisement on the front.
Oh, yes.
When I was in Dubrovnik a couple of years ago, which is also a World Heritage Site, it was very, very strict about no, none of this kind of writing. And I was wondering how the World Heritage
I understand.
Application.
Yes.
Do they say you can do these things? So that was one question. And the second question is, I remember talking to the Penang heritage people a few years ago, very scathing about what Singapore had done, about the gentrification, the raffalization of shop houses which have become boutiques where the people don't live there anymore. And they said that Little India is actually much better than the old.
I didn't show that Little India. Yeah.
That in actual fact, the people who own the shops. But now, with modernization of commodified, it's very hard for a little shop to actually survive in this. You know, unless they're a restaurant, maybe restaurants.
Yes, right.
Most of the time, it's just very difficult.
Right.
So I wonder if you had any predictions about the future of a family living upstairs, managing a shop upstairs. Can that be sustained?
The second question first, I guess, because it's much more complicated. In Singapore, they don't care about that. That's why they accept the gentrification. So, and the Singapore planning system is very strict in terms of use. So in some conservation area, it depends on the negotiation between the residents and the URA. Where they have, but the URA also have to think about the financial return for that building, because the taxation, property taxation, emitting are so high and very standardized, very very good system. So you have to be capable of doing such a business in the building. And if you want to change or you want to do some kind of a mixed uses with the single family, which is pretty difficult, because you have to ask also for the change of use in Singapore, and you have to pay fee or fine for that change. So Singapore, in some ways, is very good, as I mentioned before, that they do pretty well in the physical improvement of the shop houses, but in terms of the intangibility or the giving the priority to the people is nothing. So that's why we were talking among the and the Malaysian people and the Thai people, I think we are on the side of following the grassroots, but we have to sort of sacrifice the maybe a lower quality of the building preservation or the restoration quality. So I actually have no prediction on that, because Singapore is really heading for what is called a gentrification and make a very fine city. So it's the city's choice and the government's choice. But for us, we have to advocate and put it in the right, in the way in which we believe that this one is, would be appropriate. Let me answer the first question first. Sorry. The first question is about the World Heritage. The World Heritage Standard guidelines and all the instructions of the World Heritage stems from the practice of the European standard, right? And they are very strict with the, for instance, the Venice Charter. And it's with the restoration techniques is based on not brick monument or plaster monument, but stone monument, so which is very strict. But in Asia, I have talked many times to Richard Engelhardt about the how to make it happen to the Asian cities, because it's so chaotic in terms, like when you compare to the European cities or the European historic town, it looks so neat. Not so neat in Europe, but in here it's quite look very chaotic as well for the Asian cities. So we have allowed some flexibility for Asia. So that's why it's the work of the UNESCO Asia Pacific to work on the setting up the standard and guidelines for Asian countries or Asian cities. Otherwise, you will not allow these. You are so strict of using all the people. I was asking the Phuket residents as well, like, do you want to get into the World Heritage list as the transboundary nomination, so we can attach as we share the same culture and the same history, so we can do some kind of the transboundary nomination. It can be put in the list already, and it's much easier. But you have to trade off with the very fine and very high quality restoration. And the people in Phuket say, no, we are not going for that. So maybe what we can do is we have to tell the UNESCO that you have to make the balance between the intangible culture and tangible culture. If you want to put more effort on the preservation, on the preserving the intangibility as well, you have to sacrifice a lot, maybe a little bit more on the quality of the restoration. But what is happening now for the World Heritage regulations and standards and guidelines is they put more attention on what is called physical quality in here. So this is the process that we can do, that we have to negotiate with the UNESCO, which already quite successful for the Macau. If you go to Macau, Macau was listed to World Heritage before, and which is it's different from Luang Prabang and Hoi An, because it's under the French colony already, right? So, and for the local people or the native people, if we do on our own effort, you gotta have some kind of more flexibility for us. Yes.
I want to ask you, since you brought up Hoi An,
yes.
In Vietnam, you have the preservation was done Hoi An, including Japanese Shaka.
Yes.
Right? Uh-huh. And then you have Hanoi, where the shop houses are living entities in there. Mm-hmm. They're still functioning as shop houses.
Right.
And I just wanted to get your reaction to that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, sure.
The sort of stasis in Hoi An seems a little Disney-fied to me. This is my personal reactions. Come Disneyfication, and the certain delight in Hanoi in the fact that people are still operating and
yes.
those two. I know people who live in them. I know exactly what they're they're engaged in commerce and they're making lots of money and they don't want to move out.
Yes, right. When I was I'm still attaching with the AIT, and many AIT students are asking me for getting in the committee for the master students or the PhD students. I have one student, she's an economist, the urban economist from Vietnam, and she did a very nice, very good thesis on the economic point of view for Hoi An in terms of the conservation. We call it conservation in Asia, not preservation. So she tried to propose the economic model, and one of the things is what is lacking here is how to maintain the very good quality of the shop house facade and also the quality of the living in terms of the inner space, the interior space. But you need the money for that, right? So she was searching for the possibility of getting the money to improve at the public level. And one of her recommendations is maybe you can do some kind of the taxing the tourist, and maybe just like if you go into the area and you stay in the hotel, and the hotel has to pay one tourist $1 or one tourist $2 and put it in the trust or the foundation, and then the foundation can do something on this. And this is just for instance. So there is a resource, the financial resource in there, but you have to also, I'm not the expert of the Hoi An place, but you have to find to make the balance of the flow of the financial resource, and you have to take something out of that from the hand of the private sector maybe, and put it in maybe the non-profit to take care of the preservation, and we will be working on that just like that one. Yes? Yes.
One is, I was curious about how the lifting of the rent control act some years back in Penang has affected efforts to preserve it.
Right.
And the other one is, I really like your comparison between the three cities.
Three and a half. right.
And I'm curious to hear what your observations are about the impact of the ethno-political climate. Because these are Chinese shop houses.
Yes, right.
And,
very good point.
How the central government views what its heritage is, has a tremendous effect on why they have to choose the options here.
It would be very, I think it's easier for me as my observation and some experience in Penang and Malacca, if you compare the two cities. They are actually competing to each other, you might have known already. And in Penang, in Penang it's easier for the Chinese to work it on the ethno-oriented, because the mayor of Penang is Chinese, and sometimes,
the
new government, with the Putrajaya or the very Muslim-oriented in the country, it's very difficult.
What about the state government now that they've changed the opposition control in Penang?
I don't think so.
No.
I don't think so, yeah. Yeah, and in Malacca, it's even more difficult for the Chinese. But with the help of the NGO, they try to promote what they call the melting pot. And they have the Indian, absolutely Indian, and the Indian jetty, the Peranakan, the Chinese, the Arabian, or even the Portuguese, of course. Yes, the Portuguese one. So, but. What they are doing is so different from what Thailand is doing, because you still have a very clear cut among these people. The Peranakan is the term which is very new to the Thai people, because we have combined and mixed already in the first place, I think since, I don't know, after the Chinese discrimination in 1950s, and then we mixed with Thai already. So in Malacca it's still, you can see something like that. So, but But everyone has to follow the Muslim rules in the first place, and then they can, yeah.
But the, in Penang, the, mm-hmm. the preservation of temples, Chinese temples, is
Chinese temple.
Exemplary.
The,
very good job in a central temple.
Yes, they won the UNESCO Heritage Award.
I think
that
it
one.
Really is the, because there are
you
several,
can't see anything like that there, in China
yeah,
now.
There are several really good people in Penang who are really committed to this. Lawrence Lowe is one.
With the architecture firm as well, with the Penang Foundation. Right. Right. Right.
Right.
The Chong Fatsi, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, like historic preservation so often, it's really several people in the community that really have a vision to put this through.
Right.
I'm quickly comment a little bit on what you were saying about the, you know, the sustainability and things like that, is the, you know, so many of the signs and things you'll see are really commercial signs. Somehow suggest, provided by Coca-Cola, which used to be food, she used to do so much, but
Mm-hmm.
It was much
down. Oh, I have.
And so you get this feeling that somehow, yes, they're going to be regulated so badly, but they're being regulated against the kind of corporate signs that were more or less given to them as a way of advertising. So
in Thailand, the regulation cannot do anything because people always violate the regulations. So we have to use, it's a kind of...
Mentally would think all these poor people... They
this example can
signs,
show you...
They aren't their own signs, really. You know?
Yeah, somehow this picture can show you this. This can be done from this to this because of the local watchdog. And the housewife has just formed themselves like Anne Cunningham of Anne Pamela Cunningham of Phuket, and then they formed already together. And then they have the Phuket Old Town Foundation just established a few years ago. Yeah, and I think they figure out their own way to resolve the problem. But if we put the right effort on the strengthening or enabling them to do so, and they have all the equipment, all the knowledge, and all the information, and they can do on their own. This is my strategy to work with these points.
It's certainly gentrified, but I still think you're touching
not that much.
Mm-hmm. A different population than you would otherwise. When we were walking in that procession for Ajahn Mai's wedding, the mayor of Phuket was pointing out to me that he thought he had a lot of land interest. He thought it would be more convenient to recreate Phuket City as a shopping center, and then there would be better parking.
What you can do, and that you have to create the platform of the consultation, and you bring in all the people to talk about that and to discuss and find a solution.
Yes. I was wondering, how far back does the original shop house in China go? Because I've seen things in Hangzhou and China that look, I don't know, 10th, 11th century.
Really?
How far do this...
I made that up. Song Dynasty.
Song Dynasty.
It's dark 2010.
Yeah, my study is really new. It's very recent, I think. Heritage.
Has anybody studied that? Where this comes? Is it coastal China?
Not really.
That conference in Hong Kong, there were people talking about. There was a conference in Hong Kong 2 years ago about the. People had some talk about the.
Teaching as a visiting faculty of the University of Hong Kong for 6 years and some students, but they are using the Phuket as a case to deal with the Wan Chai community in Hong Kong, and at one as they are following the way that we negotiate with the people, but not that the matter of the looking at the history of the shop houses. Yeah. Which is really interesting, and keep in mind.
Military engineers.
I think there's
a lot to indicate this whole creolization of the shop house,
right.
The introduction of neoclassical forms.
Mm-hmm.
British architects working for the army in the Caribbean, actually.
They even study where the hip roof from. The hip roof. Yes?
Suggested that, I mean, when the city of Hanoi, as we see it now, goes way back, what we see now that around the establishment of the citadel and the Ban Miu about the 11th century, it was said that Chinese merchants came very, very quickly after that to service the palace, and
in Hanoi.
The possibility of merchant houses and merchant housing having existed as early as the 12th century.
Yeah, they were torn down a lot during the French colony, right?
Well, now what we see is...
Yes, now what we see is just one. Right, right, right.
I was wondering if anybody knows anything about it.
Let's have some ancient map that we can trace back. I have no much information about Hanoi.
Existing Chinese.
Yeah. Yeah.
How far? We don't know how far back.
Just try. Yeah.
But you know, this transformation, this kind of combination of European design, seems to be something quite late, like early 19th century.
Oh, I'm so happy to discuss with the historian and the archaeologist. You really go back in time. I like it so much.
I mean, you like to give some reference about these British architects working with the army. And there's a lot of logic.
We
better get that people going
on. Yeah. Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Mahalo for listening to the Center for Southeast Asian Studies.